Okay, let's unpack this. A scenario that might pop into the minds of future lawyers, anyone intrigued by family law, what happens when a divorce agreement includes promises about the kids' futures, like paying for college, that are supposed to extend beyond the child's 18th birthday? Is that promise just like a hopeful note, or can it actually be enforced legally?
That's a really insightful starting point. It immediately brings up, well, the interplay between different areas of law, specifically contract principles, and the defined scope of family court authority. What's fascinating here is seeing how a personal agreement, made within a family law context can have implications in a completely different legal arena.
Exactly. And to really get our heads around this, we're taking a deep dive into a pivotal 1991 Arizona Supreme Court case, Solomon v. Findley. This case essentially drew a clear distinction when it comes to agreements for support that continue after a child legally becomes an adult.
Yeah.
Think of it as a landmark decision that clarifies whether those promises about future educational funding are legally binding and, just as importantly, where you'd go to make sure they're honored.
Precisely. Solomon v. Findley is a great example of how courts balance the intent of divorcing parties with the specific powers granted to different branches of the legal system. It makes us consider the full lifespan of obligations created during a divorce, extending even beyond, well, the traditional bounds of family court jurisdiction.
So for you, the listener, whether you're currently studying law, maybe navigating a similar situation yourself, or simply have a keen interest in how the legal system works, this deep dive will provide a clear understanding of whether these educational support agreements and divorce decrees are truly binding and, as we've hinted, the appropriate court to seek enforcement.
Yeah.
Our discussion today is rooted in the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling in Solomon v. Findley itself, along with some expert analysis to help us navigate the key legal concepts.
And our goal is really to break down this potentially intricate legal issue into its essential parts. We want you to leave this discussion with a solid grasp of the key takeaways and the fundamental reasoning behind this significant court decision.
All right, so let's set the stage. Picture this. It's 1976, and Wilma Solomon and Lloyd Findley are going through a divorce. Now, their divorce agreement contained a really specific element, a contractual provision stating that Mr. Findley would provide financial support for their daughter Adrienne's education, covering either her college expenses or continuing until she reached 25, whichever came first. And it's crucial, the court later emphasized this. This wasn't just a casual understanding. It was a formal contractual provision written into their legally binding divorce decree.
That's a really important distinction to emphasize. It wasn't just like a verbal agreement or a stated intention. It was formalized within the legal framework of their divorce settlement. So fast forward several years, Adrienne grows up, reaches adulthood, and, well, as you might guess, Mr. Finley's payments towards her education stopped.
Exactly. So Mrs. Solomon's initial reaction was probably, head back to the family court to try and enforce this. Seems logical, right? That's where the original divorce order came from.
Sure, makes sense on the surface.
But the family court essentially said, we don't have the authority to handle this now. Adrienne is no longer a minor. This immediately raises a critical question for us. If the family court can't enforce it, where can such an agreement be legally pursued?
And this situation really highlights the defined boundaries of family court jurisdiction. Family courts are typically focused on issues directly related to, dissolving the marriage and the care of minor children. Their statutory power, the authority given to them by law, generally ends when a child hits 18.
Right.
So following the family court's refusal, Mrs. Solomon took a different path. She filed a breach of contract lawsuit against Mr. Finley, this time in civil court,
Yeah.
but the trial court then dismissed her claim based on a legal principle known as the merger doctrine.
Okay, the merger doctrine. This sounds like a pivotal concept we need to wrap our heads around. So in the context of divorce settlements, what exactly does it mean when an agreement merges into a court decree?
Okay, think of it this way. The merger doctrine essentially says that when a settlement agreement is formally incorporated into a court's final decree or judgment, the agreement can, well, in some ways, lose its independent existence as a separate contract.
Huh, like it gets absorbed.
Yeah, exactly. It's as if the contract is absorbed into the court order itself. The underlying idea is to create finality in legal proceedings and allow for enforcement of the settlement terms through the court's power to enforce its own decrees.
So in the Solomon v. Findley case, the trial court was basically arguing that the agreement about Adrienne's education had been absorbed into the divorce decree, and so Mrs. Solomon couldn't bring a separate lawsuit in civil court claiming a breach of that original contract.
Precisely. The trial court's reasoning was that the original contractual promise no longer existed independently once it became part of the divorce decree. This brings us right to the central legal question the Arizona Supreme Court had to tackle in Solomon v. Finley. Did that specific post-majority support provision really merge into the decree so completely that it legally stopped Mrs. Solomon from pursuing a separate breach of contract claim in civil court?
And the Arizona Supreme Court's answer to that was pretty decisive, wasn't it? What was their ultimate conclusion?
They were very clear. I know. The Arizona Supreme Court definitively held that, in this specific situation, the provision for Adrian's post-majority educational support did not merge into the divorce decree in a way that killed its independent status as a contract.
Wow. Okay.
This meant that Ms. Solomon did have the right to sue Mr. Finley for breach of contract in civil court.
Okay, that's the core finding. But what was the crucial reasoning that led the Supreme Court there? Why didn't the merger doctrine fully apply here?
The court's reasoning really hinged on a fundamental point: the defined statutory authority of Arizona family courts. They specifically pointed to Arizona revised statutes, sections 25.320 and 327. These laws outline the specific powers granted to family courts.
Okay.
And importantly, they do not give family courts the legal authority to generally enforce child support obligations once a child reaches the age of majority, which, as we mentioned, is 18 in Arizona.
Ah, so because the family court lacked the legal power, the jurisdiction, to enforce this specific educational support provision after Adrian turned 18.
Right.
It couldn't have fully merged into the decree in a way that would wipe out its underlying contractual basis. Is that the idea?
Exactly. The court reasoned that for a true merger to happen, the court usually needs the power to actually enforce the incorporated agreement. Since the family court's jurisdiction over standard child support ends at 18, it couldn't have fully absorbed and taken over enforcing this obligation that stretched beyond that age. So the original contractual promise remained independently enforceable.
That makes a lot of sense. It's not just about whether the agreement is written into the court order. It's also about whether that specific type of agreement falls within that court's legal power to enforce in the first place.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the court also brought up an important underlying policy point. They wanted to uphold the freedom of individuals to contract for things that might go beyond what state law specifically requires,
mm-hmm.
while also respecting the clear jurisdictional lines between different courts. If they'd ruled that merger applied automatically here, it could have essentially nullified perfectly valid agreements for post-majority support just because the family court couldn't enforce them.
Yeah, that would create a really strange situation, wouldn't it? Where a seemingly valid promise becomes legally useless because of a technicality about which court has the power?
Indeed. And this decision actually led the Arizona Supreme Court to explicitly overrule a prior case, Helber v. Frizzell. Helber had suggested a more, let's say, automatic application of merger in divorce cases. Solomon v. Finley corrected that view, making it clear that courts really need to look at the jurisdictional limits of the family court when deciding if merger happened for a specific provision.
That's a big deal, explicitly overturning a previous ruling. It really shows a shift in thinking, doesn't it? Was there a key quote from the Solomon v. Finley ruling that really nails this central idea?
Yes, there's a very telling line. The divorce court only has jurisdiction to enforce child support provisions until the child reaches a majority. The significance of this quote is it directly connects merger to the court's jurisdictional boundaries.
Right.
If the court doesn't have the power to enforce something after a certain point here, post-majority support, then that obligation doesn't truly merge into the decree in a way that stops it from being enforced as a contract somewhere else, like civil court.
So for all the law students tuning in, this case really highlights a crucial legal distinction. You've got court-ordered child support, enforceable in family court, but usually only until the child is 18. Then you have these contractual obligations for support that go beyond 18, like paying for college. Solomon v. Finley clarifies that these later agreements, even if they're in a divorce decree, can live on as separate contracts, enforceable in civil court.
Exactly. The practical takeaway here is that parents can legally agree to provide support for their children beyond age 18, and these agreements are legally enforceable. But the critical detail is that if you need to take legal action, the right place is civil court, not family court.
And it sounds like the way these agreements were actually written becomes really important because of this ruling, right?
Absolutely. Solomon v. Finley really underscores the importance of drafting these post-majority support agreements clearly. Ideally, they should be set out as distinct contractual provisions, either right in the divorce decree or maybe in a separate agreement alongside it.
To make it crystal clear,
Yeah, this helps solidify their status as independent contracts and minimizes arguments later about whether they fully merged into the divorce decree and lost their separate punch.
So the big legal principle here seems to be that courts generally respect people's freedom to make private contracts, even during a divorce, especially when those contracts cover things outside the family court's specific legal turf.
That's an excellent summary. The court is essentially balancing the need for finality in divorce with the fundamental legal idea of upholding agreements people freely make.
So to recap the main insight from our deep dive into Solomon v. Finley,
Those
agreements for support after a child turns 18, even if part of a divorce decree, don't just vanish legally. They can stick around as enforceable contracts. They just might need a different courtroom, civil court, if enforcement becomes an issue.
Precisely. It's a really important reminder that the legal landscape can be nuanced, you know? Understanding the specific powers and limits of different courts is crucial for figuring out how and where an agreement can actually be enforced.
This leads to a really interesting thought for our listeners to chew on. Given this Solomon v. Finley ruling, how might the way lawyers actually negotiate and draft divorce agreements involving kids' future support change? What kind of strategic things might legal pros need to keep in mind when advising clients now?
That's a very insightful question. It really gets at the practical impact of this Supreme Court decision. It pushes us to think critically about how lawyers can best protect their clients' intentions and make sure agreements looking towards future education are actually enforceable down the road.
Absolutely. And for those of you who want to explore this more, we definitely recommend digging deeper into Arizona family law and contract law. Really get into the nuances of the Solomon v. Finley decision and its lasting effects on divorce practice there. It's a fascinating intersection of different legal areas at work